The key phrases in the ancient world was, time is the moving image of eternity. This is in Plato's Timaeus. And has been a paradoxical phrase for the non-philosopher since it was propounded. We'll be able to see tonight in the Asclepius why time is a moving image of eternity and why this statement is an insight comparable to the Einstein equation E equals mc squared. It is the key to the cosmology of the ancient world, the key to the Platonic tradition, which in time had infused itself with a Stoic physics. It's very difficult to come across information on Stoic physics. The central figure in that development was Posidonius. And we have very little on Posidonius that's available. Perhaps the best short chapter is in the history of philosophy done by the great French savant, Émile Dreyfus. And if you will look up in his Hellenistic volume in the history of philosophy, he will give you a short chapter, I think 10, 12 pages. That's as much as is known about Posidonius. We know from the influence of the story that it was a tremendous infusion of order into man's mind. One of the great students of this Stoic order was Cicero. And in Cicero's more arcane work, we find reflectively keys to the development of thought initiated by Posidonius and the Stoic. The name Stoic, of course, comes from Stoa, which were the arcades, the columns in Athens, under which the Stoics were said to teach. But Posidonius was from the Aegean island and held his teaching in rather a sacred manner. It was not to be propounded in the forum, in the Stoa. And so the Stoic, because of its cosmology, the full development of Stoic material outlook on the world is in Lucretius, De Rerum Natura. This infusion of a Stoic science for a mental order is a knowledge, is a scientia, is a knowing, a body of coordinated information that expands itself through investigation, the investigation being a rotation through experience of a methodology, and the methodology being an outlook of application of an interior structure of order perceived and held together by a religious conviction. This interpenetration, which happened most profoundly at the close of the first stage of the Hellenistic era, that is about 145 BC, there was a tremendous upheaval of the human psyche in 145 BC. There were concomitant political thralls in Egypt and Alexandria. The whole integrity of the Ptolemaic dynasty broke at that time. There were changes that manifested themselves in the Roman mind. The tremendous pressure of the Punic War, the power of Hannibal, the brutalizing of the Roman sensibility by generation upon generation of war, all of these came to a crest around 145 BC. The document most known in the world, which is expressive of this apocalyptic revelation of man's uncertain nature in the cosmos, and his certain need to be delivered from this uncertainty is to be found in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. The book of Daniel is written about this time. The effectiveness of the image base coordinated by the vision of the book of Daniel is noticeable, because the next production that we have after the Maccabean period is the Wisdom of Ben-Sirah. And if you compare the quandary of man in Daniel to the Wisdom of Ben-Sirah, you see that some major change has happened in the spirit of man. He has learned something profound. Now, the book of Daniel structures itself on the ability of man to penetrate through all of the layers of his mind. And the layers most problematical in his mind are those experiential horizons which we call ecstatic, transcendental, the dream states, the unconscious so-called states, the subconscious states, those areas of his experience which normally lie beyond the pale. The penetration to those levels and the incorporation of content, of experience, anchored there, found there, brought back into a fructified consciousness is what gave man his stability, what produced the Wisdom of Solomon, the book written in Alexandria about 50 years ago. Out of all of this incursion from the unknown, from the unconscious, from the other realms, into man's mind, into his life, into his living, gave him a new stability, one which was larger, more complete than the one that he had enjoyed and despaired of before. This process was a healing process in the largest sense. And this is where Asclepius comes in, because Asclepius was the god of healing. That is to say, he was the god of healing because it had been delegated to him by Apollo. We have to digress for just a moment. There are three primal states that take us outside of ourselves. One is ecstasy, which was embodied in the goddess Aphrodite. Two is horror, which was embodied in the god Ares, the god of war. And three, there is wisdom, insight, and which was embodied in the goddess Athena. Wisdom, or insight, is an interpenetration of horror and ecstasy, of the masculine feminine. And thus, Athena is feminine, but she is armed like Ares. So the armed woman becomes a symbol of that synthesizing third transcendental mode. But all three of those modes, when brought together, constitute the realm of Apollo. Apollo, as a god, is different from Zeus, who rules the Olympic pantheon. Apollo does not rule an Olympic pantheon. He focuses the transcendental state of man into a unity. Thus he is above all the image of the unity of man's psyche carried to the highest level. A sub-footnote here. If you wish to investigate this, there's a parallel in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali for the in the fourth book, the development of the yogic state known as pranayama is Apollonian application. Now to get back to Asclepius. Apollo thus in his equanimity, is a focus of a triad of transcendental states of man. And he has three major functions corresponding to those three states. Those three functions were medicine, music, and prophecy. Prophecy was centered physically at Delphi, and music as a harmony, as a harmonizing of man's world, was centered at Delos, the physical, external aspect, the political order. The third function, that of medicine, was focused at Epidaurus. And Epidaurus is where the ancient Asclepius was. The home of Asclepius was not just anywhere, it was at Epidaurus. And in fact, in historical times, the god was moved from Epidaurus with great fanfare, with great trepidation. And it happened in 293 BC. The circumstances were following. A great plague, pestilence, had swept over a great part of the Western classical world and was decimating the newly risen city of Rome. Rome was at this time enjoying its first sense of integration as a power. This was the Rome that was to produce very shortly the kind of leadership embodied in Scipio Africanus. A religious ceremony was conducted in the city of Rome, and surprisingly what was revealed was that Rome was suffering from this illness as a city. The Roman people were suffering from this plague as a people to prepare them to receive a new god, a new divinity. For they were told that Asclepius should move from Epidaurus to Rome, so that the third function, the restoration to health of man, of Apollo, should be centered in Rome, so that Rome should join Delphi and Delos as part of the sacred triad of the harmony of the world. We are used to thinking of Rome in its later empire manifestation as an engineering power, as a military power. We are somewhat blinded by our tradition, by our education, which skews our mind in this way. The Republic of Rome, in 293 BC, sent a large delegation to Epidaurus. And there, the people of Epidaurus were loath to give up their god. But in the Asclepius, the process of healing, of consultation with the god, was to prepare oneself by purification, to open up the unconscious, to allow for the unknown to penetrate into the known. And the messenger symbol of Asclepius was a serpent, often called a golden serpent. In a time where the focus of the ceremony, should the god move to Rome, what is going to happen to Epidaurus? The serpent appeared. The priests of Asclepius and Epidaurus, in a frightened state of mind, called everyone to attention and to move back. The serpent left the temple of Epidaurus and made its way down to the quay where the Roman ships were and climbed on board voluntarily of itself. There was no doubt in antiquity, in 293 BC, that the god had spoken. The ships sailed all the way back to Rome, stopping at many places. The serpent occupied the prow of the ship and eventually made their way back to the city of Rome. And there, on an island in the middle of the Tiber River, the serpent made itself home. And so this island was shaped as a sanctuary to Asclepius, and the architecture was in the shape of a ship. And in the on the left-hand side, near the prow of the ship, was a bust of Asclepius inserted into the side as an element of a frieze into the rock, shaped ship. And this was the new home of Asclepius, and Rome then became sacred in the sense that it was the center of the medicine power, the healing power of Apollo. It had then recourse, along with Delphi and along with Delos, to the resources of archetypal unconsciousness for mankind. Thus Rome, after that, was in the classical mind an inevitable center of power, especially that power which was to heal man, the healing of mankind. It is no accident that the early Christian church was founded in Rome. It is also no accident that Augustus Caesar, when he brought together the powers of the ancient world in 30 AD, brought together all of the books of the Sibylline prophecy and kept them in Rome because it was a legitimate center of this kind of power. We're not used to thinking of Rome in this way. But from this aspect, Rome gained its appellation of the Eternal City. And Rome becomes the archetype of this manifestation, of this incarnation, of the healing power of Apollo for all mankind. Thus the Pax Romana is not essentially a political or a military net thrown from the outside. It is a development from this spiritual recognition and realization from the inside. These two elements cross. The development of Asclepius and Apollo's medicine power, healing power, sent to Rome for a new home, and that other tradition that we began with, Plato and Posidonius, the Stoics. They meet about the time of Cicero, about 60 BC, 60 to 90 BC. It is at about this time that the origins of the Asclepius, this Hermetic text, can be located. In fact, there are three distinct writings which are grouped under the title Asclepius. In the GRS Mead version, they are largely put together in unity, but in the W. Scott Hermetica, in four volumes, published originally by Oxford in 1928, and reissued here by Dawkins of Pall Mall in England, Helmel, in 1968. And so I will use Scott Hermetica because the text is a little more clear. It is interesting to note that the original title was not simply Asclepius. In fact, it's a very strange document because it is one of the few Hermetic works that has come down to us in Latin. And the Latin was translated from a primordial Greek manuscript. But here we need to go to the original title of the Greek manuscript, which has been preserved for us. And the original manuscript in Greek of the Asclepius was entitled, in Greek, Hermes Trismegistos Biblios Ire Iota Epsilon Rho Alpha, I-E-R-A. And the word Ire in Greek originally meant serpent, snake, serpent. But its later connotation in Greek it meant serpent at the time of Aristotle, but by the time of Galen, it meant medicine. A medicine. Any medicine with the ear. This means that there's a connection between the snake, the serpent, and its healing function, and medicine and its healing function. I think the notion here is a little poison goes a long way to restoring health. I guess I should make some puns in honor of dear Dr. Heller, but I'm trying to refrain to keep my mind clear. Once bitten, thrice saved. Quite good. The fourth word was pros, which is a preposition meaning in direction of, and there then comes asclepia. And the final word was prosponesia, which means it's a compound word. It means an address from divinity. But a very particular address from the divinity. It's one that has overtones of purification. And in the Greek language, is hidden the imagery, because by purification, they meant by fumigation. If you read the ancient Orphic hymn, there's always a fumigation of one kind or another. The fumigation in this case is a medicine fumigation, which involves sulfur, which is one of the alchemical elements. So purification by fumigation with sulfur. So this is a divine address about purifying man by a very strong dose of something primeval, and it's done by Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepios via the method of the serpent medicine. That's what the original title meant. But the manuscript that we have three manuscripts of the Asclepios. The most important one, copied down, has written then under this Greek title, the Latin title of Asclepios, and a little Latin phrase in the side, which reads in Latin, "Iste pro sole mihi est," which roughly translated means that this was very valuable to the copy. This work was extremely valuable. He's giving his own personal testimony. Now, aside from the complicated Greek title, which I've given you, it was then known colloquially in antiquity by the title Logos Teleos, which roughly translated means the crowning discourse, the word, the discourse, but the last discourse, the discourse which completes a implied previous instruction. So that this crowning discourse, the Asclepios then, is the keystone of the whole Hermetic corpus. If you take the Hermetic corpus, as one should, as an arch of meaning, Masonic ceremony of the Royal Arch here, very valuable in reconstructing the method by which this kind of array of learning is held together in a structure of understanding. The keystone of this Royal Arch of the Hermetic doctrine is the Asclepios. So that it is the crowning discourse, not only because it comes at the end, or should come at the end of the instruction. In fact, it shouldn't come at the end, it should come at the middle. You see, the classic mind was not a serial mind like ours. Our mind is all gummed up by ideas of equations and theories and so forth. The classic mind is schooled on the Homeric epic vision of unity, and thus the focus is in the center. The four elements, none of the four elements hold the world together. The fifth element holds the quintessence, holds the world together. The fifth element being, of course, mind, which is a mirror of the ether. It is not any of the four elements. And so the center, the focus, the fulcrum, is the crown and not the end. This is important later on because of the notion of the Christos is not that he is the end, but that he is the focus. He is the crown, this is the focus. This is how the classical world works. So we have, in the Asclepius then, a promise that we are here to have a keystone of the whole Hermetic doctrine. Again, the phrase that we started with tonight, from Plato's Timaeus, time is the moving image of eternity. And we need to make our way to this, because in the Asclepius, this is the position of understanding by the mind in which the keystone can be seen in place. The relationship of time and eternity is the core relationality in the Hermetic doctrine. It is the perception of this that heals man, that restores him to health, that allows him to function in the world as he should, because he has a necessary structure in the world and an indelible integrity committed to performing that function. In the Hermetic doctrine, anything abrogating this responsibility is not only a travesty of man's justice, but a travesty of divine justice. And we pay for that. So we turn to the Asclepius, and the first part now is being composed somewhere around 70 BC. The second part will be composed probably around the time of Christ, the turn of the millennium. And the third part will be composed around 260 AD, so that we span then in the Asclepius about 350 years of development, the later Hellenistic development. At the beginning of the Asclepius, Hermes Trismegistus is going to deliver this sacred teaching to Asclepius. And the classical idea of sacredness was that it was a celestial order, and that in order to prepare a vessel to receive a sacred order, one must prepare a holy form. And thus, Hermes Trismegistus cannot deliver the sacred order to Asclepius alone, because a dialogue between two is not a holy form. There needs to be at least four, a quaternary. And so Hermes Trismegistus, at the very beginning, sends Asclepius out to bring in two other worthwhile students, one his son Thoth, and the other a promising student named Amun. These are very potent names. And so Amun and Thoth form a relationship, and Asclepius and Hermes Trismegistus form a relationship. And these four together form a holy receptacle, so that now the sacred celestial order may be brought down and given to them. Hermes, in fact, cautions Asclepius that it is not he who will think this out, not he that will deliver it, He will be the mouthpiece of the God. The God will deliver it. In fact, the article, the neutering article, does not appear in the Greek, and there is simply the declaration that God will speak. So that this is to be a sacred treatise. And the preservation of it is to be a holy act. So once the this prologue is finished, and it finishes this way, then Ammon also entered the sanctuary, and the place was made holy by the pious awe of the four men, and was filled with God's presence. Before one could speak, there must be the presence of the God. Before the God could be present, there must be the holy receptacle. And the hearers listened in fitting silence, and with heart and soul, each of them hung on the words in reverence, as though the lips of Hermes, the divine arrow, thus began to speak. Hermes, of course, now is the divine arrow, the messenger of the gods. Hermes Trismegistus is able to speak and control this discourse because of Hermes, the divine arrow, coming in. The divine eros means that man has, on an archetypal level, a love for God. Not just a need to know, not just a curiosity, but a love for God. And it's this love that allows him to open up, and in the opening up, to receive an interchange. An active love is an interchange, as Hermes will say later on. And in this interchange, the partners to the interchange temporarily, for a moment, in an epiphany, change roles. Hermes will say that in the act of sexual procreation, in deep love, a man and a woman, for a moment, change roles. The woman becomes masculine in her vigor, and the man becomes feminine in his languor. Now, this is an indication that there has been an exchange of selves, temporarily, showing that the material orders of the world are not firm, that they dissolve. They dissolve in an interpenetrative way, which reveals that there is a sustaining continuity below the seeming order, and that to join that continuity is to go outside oneself, and in this case, to go outside oneself to prepare to hear a divine message. And of course, Hermes Trismegistus begins with something all human souls are immortal. But souls are not all of one kind. Different souls have been created in different fashions, for souls differ in quality. And it goes on in this manner. And now, give me your whole attention, exerting to the utmost your power of thought and keenness of intelligence, for the doctrine which teaches of God's being needs for its apprehension such efforts of thought as man cannot make save by God's help. And then Hermes will now give a metaphor saying why we must apply ourselves to the utmost exertion. We must give in the hearing of this doctrine 100%. Why is this so? Hermes Trismegistus says, it is like a torrent plunging head down with headlong rush, so that in its swiftness it outstrips the man who strives to follow it, and leaves behind not only the hearers, but even the teacher himself. In other words, if we preserve for ourselves some ego basis, some cuteness, some criticalness, some discretion, we will never hear what it says. We will never follow, because the flow of truth is like a waterfall, a headlong plunge. And if we're trying to be self-conscious and containment with ourselves, we will be outstripped by it. It will leave us, and we will only be able to apprehend appearances and illusions. We will get the tinkle of the tinsel. We will miss the radiance of the gold flash. Hermes then goes on to assure us about this, that man is extraordinarily important in the order of the cosmos. And he tells Asclepius that there are in fact three different spheres that need to be taken into consideration. There is man's sphere, there is the cosmic sphere, and there is the supra-cosmic sphere. And that man has a very important function because of his adaptability. One can think here, the later Renaissance presentation of this was in Pico della Mirandola's On the Dignity of Man, that man is important because he alone of all the manifestations in the universe can be anything. Man is the mercurial spirit in the universe. He can change because of his adaptability. He can be like demons, he can be like angels, he can be like gods, he can be like beasts. He has this supreme adaptability, and is this mercurial aspect, which is his quintessence. That is to say, he is transformable by nature. His nature is not to be an animal. His nature is not to be a god. His nature is to be transformable. The reputed translator of the Asclepius in antiquity was Apuleius, who is the author of the Metamorphoses, better known in our time as the Golden Axe. A man who, through witchcraft, is transformed into a donkey and has to go through all kinds of adventures before he can be transformed back to a man. Apuleius lived from about 120 to about 180 AD. He was the reputed translator of the Asclepius. Man is a marvel, then, Asclepius. Honor and reverence to such a being. Man takes on him the attributes of a god as though he were himself a god. He is familiar with the demon kind, for he comes to know that he is sprung from the same source as they. And strong in the assurance of that in him which is divine, he scorns the merely human part of his own nature. So that one of the delusions that man falls into is to identify himself as a man. This is the narcissistic pride that leads to a whole involvement in a labyrinth of his own making. He refuses to see himself as a transformation and decides that he's a man, and he's going to be a man. And this is a fatal mistake. But there are many different kinds of men. In fact, there are so many different kinds of men because there are so many transformations that man must make. Because his purpose, his function, is to tend the material world. And it needs tending. The reason why it needs tending is because it, of its own operation, produces evil. The matter here is in Greek, hyle. Of its own operation, evil is produced. Man must therefore tend matter, tend the hyletic world. And he countermands evil by his worship, by his sacrifice. But of man, that focus that keystone, which allows him to comprehend this function and to produce it, is his mind. Hermes delivers to Asclepius then, the soul is nourished by the ceaseless movement of fire and air, the higher elements. The growth of bodies is supplied from water and earth, the lower elements. But mind, a fifth component part, which comes from the ether, the demiurge does not like anyone to do this, much less believe it. They're all being clouded by sleep and distraction. Don't. Mind is a fifth component part, which comes from the ether, has been bestowed on man alone. Very peculiar. This makes of man's condition not only an existential quandary, but it makes of man finally, if he recognizes, if he remembers all, it is he who is the quintessential, who sets the keystone in place. It is he who heals the universe. Man is the medicine man for the cosmos. He returns it to health. If he does not do it, no one does it. Hermes will say later to Asclepius, towards the end of Asclepius, this is why, Asclepius, when you look around you, you see that the world is turned to pure evil. And Hermes, in the Asclepius, will go into a couple pages of almost an apocalyptic tirade against the times. And it reads almost like the Book of Revelation, which was not written by John. It's a Jewish apocalyptic book. Very, very strong. So mind is a fifth component part which comes from the ether, has been bestowed in man alone, and of all beings that have soul, man is the only one whose faculty of cognition is, by this gift of mind, so strengthened, elevated, and exalted that he can attain to knowledge of the truth concerning God. The only place in the whole universe where this can be recognized, where it can be remembered, where it can be manifested, is in man. So we have a great responsibility. Thus he must understand the nature of healing. He must understand the structure of medicine. He must understand that this is applicable towards truth on a transcendental focus of Apollo, in terms of the classical image. But he notices that Asclepius is getting a little edgy, a little jittery. But I see, Asclepius, that you are eager and impatient to be told how man can ken heaven or the things in heaven. He says, I see you as a student fidgeting. And your mind is drumming up questions you'd like to know. And so he replies, and the only way that a spiritual teacher could reply to such a thing, the first thing is to get rid of possession. Not to simply get rid of the things you don't need. Get rid of the addiction to possession. Possession with a capital P. It is this balance, this moraine ring of misplaced eros, misplaced desire, that opaques the mind and stops it from operating in its purely divine function. Instead of desiring God, it desires sin. As long as it's desiring anything other than God, it's never going to work. And so he tells him that in order to purify ourselves, in order to let go of all these possessions, we have been given wonderful gifts like the Muses who have come down to give us some idea of order. And then realizing that Asclepius is still not there, still harboring some kind of reluctance, which is usual with humans. He says, "And now, Asclepius, I desire to listen with strong effort of thought, as well as with keen penetration, to that which I am about to expound to you." This constant admonishment to clean up your perception. And perception is a very critical act. It has to be composing in its function. If it is simply dead and passive, it does not compose, but it operates according to puppet strings of other powers. In order to be controlled, in control of our perception, we need to compose it as it is happening. This is why our attentiveness has to be in the act of the moment. It has to be instantaneous, Zen-like. Otherwise, we are prey to subconscious structures, habits, patterns, short circuits that have all come up beforehand, and they come into play. It is only when we are rapier keen in the moment that we could have any entrance to truth. And so Asclepius is being told here. "It is a doctrine which the many do not believe, but which should be accepted as sound and true by men of saintlier mind. Thus I begin. God, the master of eternity, is first." Here's our first definition of God. God is the master of eternity. "The cosmos is second." The cosmos. We have to think here now in Alexandrian thought, as early as the 2nd century BC, the image of the cosmos was not so much of the kind of universe that we imagine to ourselves, not the image of galactic structures, but the cosmos was seen as a primal man, an anthropos. Christ was the image of the cosmos. Before the material comes into being, there is an image of the cosmos that has a definite shape. It has a shape than of a primal man. God is the master of eternity. Cosmos is second. Cosmos, then, the anthropos, will be the master of time. Man is third. God, the maker of the cosmos and of all things that are therein, governs all things, but has made man as a composite being to govern in conjunction with him, so that man cooperates with this cosmos as a whole. So there is a symbiotic relationship between the master of time, he who orders history into a unity, and man. There is a relationship reciprocal between them. "Seeing, then, that man has been thus made and fashioned and been appointed by the Supreme God to such tasks of service and of worship, because it is only by man's function as a sacrificer, as a worshiper, that he keeps evil tender in the paletic realm. And it is only by that action which he has to purify himself first to qualify for that. He has to make himself holy before that sacred order can be effected. It is only then in that rarefied condition that he actually cooperates with the cosmos. And the cosmos then produces what we would call nature, the natural universe. At the end of the first section of the Asclepia, the conversation finally comes around to Hermes says, Asclepios, all of this is usually lost sight of, usually in education, especially in philosophy. The students do not grasp this essential continuity of meaning. And the reason they don't grasp it is that there have been sophistic interruptions in the presentation of this education. And we get sidetracked. He says, in this way, Asclepius, by a cunning sort of study, in which philosophy will be mixed with diverse and unintelligible sciences, such as arithmetic, music, and geometry, wherein the student of philosophy, undefiled, which is dependent, whereas the student of philosophy, undefiled, which is dependent on devotion to God, and on that alone, ought to direct his attention to the other sciences only so far as he may thereby learn and see and marvel how the returns of the heavenly bodies to their former places, their halts, in preordained position, and the variations of their movement are true to the reckonings of number, only so far as learning the measurements of the earth, the depths of the sea, the force of fire, all of this is leading him to revere, adore, and praise God's skill and wisdom. The codification of this in the rabbinic tradition is that man's function is to consecrate the name of the Lord. He has only that real function. All other functions come out of this. This is a late development in terms of the Hellenic world, and it shows at this time now an inner penetration. Jewish and Greek notions have interpenetrated, have exchanged something of each other. But in this process, there was a third element, the Stoic science, the Stoic physics, which allows for this interchange to take place in terms of a material metaphor, so that now the interchange is expressed in the second part of the Asclepius in terms of a physical universe. What becomes paramount now is, what is the design of the whole? Trismegistus says, in the beginning were God and matter. Notice now, in the beginning were God and matter. The elements of which the universe is composed were not then in existence, because they had not yet come into being. But they were already in that form from which they were to be generated. That is to say, they were already unified and integrated in the cosmic realm before the cosmic realm became material. Thus the notion here, which developed, was that the primal man was a precedent to the physical universe. And because he was a precedent to it, in a sense was the context out of which it developed, he will be antecedent to it also. And the further notion here is that for man, in man's world, the only way that he can determine what is happening in the material world is to compute relations and ratios from moments of pulse. He has to perceive that there are cycles, and that there are apt times when cycles begin again and when they end, and that by keeping track of all the halts, as they say here, by keeping track of the interpenetration of all the cycles of nature, he begins to perceive by his mind the structure, the design of the cosmos which underlies the physical universe, and recognizes therein that from which the universe comes in time to that which it returns to in eternity. The second part of the Asclepios, which is very short, begins then with the admonition that you must not then, my pupil, speak as many do who say that God ought by all means to have freed the world from evil. To those who speak thus, not a word ought to be said in answer. Don't reply, said it all. But for your sake, I will pursue my argument, and therewith explain this. It was beyond God's power to put a stop to evil and expel it from the universe. For evil is present in the world in such sort that it is manifestly an inseparable part thereof. Evil is an inseparable part of the world. You cannot have the world and not have evil too. It is because of this inherent structural design necessity that man is given God-like power to redemption. He redeems the world through his mind, through his quintessence, through comprehending the transcendental purposes of worship and sacrifice, and how they focus in a transcendental realm, and that the focus of that is the cosmic man. In the third and concluding part of this Asclepios, Trismegistus will begin to talk here about spirit. In Greek, then, pneuma, matter. He whom we name God supreme, a God apprehensible by thought alone, is the ruler and director of that God perceptible by sense, who embraces within himself all substances and all matter and all things without exception that have to do with birth and production. Spirit, which is subject to the will of the supreme God and serves him as his instrument, is that means by which are moved or directed all kinds of beings in the universe, each in accordance with the special character assigned to it by God. Matter is the recipient of all forms and the changes and unbroken successions. Of the forms are wrought by means of spirit. This process is directed by God, who distributes life to all things. He will often use the phrase in a hermetic sense that what he distributes is the light of life, that life is a light to matter, and by distributing life, one creates a light of comprehension by which we can know, specifically by which we can remember. This light permeates the cosmos. There's nothing in the cosmos that is dead. Just as Hermes will say specifically that you must understand the structure of this, that the religious mind cannot conceive of a void. It cannot conceive of something dead, and it cannot conceive of something voided. This is perverse, he will say. That there are many who ostensibly say that they can do this, that they do this. But this is a mind that has lost its sacred focus. For the whole of it is alive with the light of life, and man has mobility and freedom and access. He can
that essence. He says, in all things he infuses spirit, assigning it to each in large measure or in proportion as the thing stands higher in the scale of being. And this, of course, is the beginning of the transition from the early Hermetic doctrines, which is very akin to the Essene doctrines, to the later doctrines that would be identified with Plotinus, Neoplatonic. So the Asclepius is giving us a bridge here between three great phases of religious thought in antiquity. The early beginning, around 145 BC, the tremendous development of it to the turn of the millennium, and the denouement, if you wish, of the tragic realization of what has happened to civilization in the world and man in late Hellenistic antiquity. In fact, here Hermes says, but as to void, which most people think to be a thing of great importance, I hold that no such thing as void exists, and can have existed in the past or will ever exist. Because of time, I'll have to skip over here. He makes then a whole outline for Asclepius of the physical world in terms of its spiritual relationalities. Gross matter, the various elements, earth and water on the denser level, and the air and fire on the upper. The mind, of course, being able to go between all of these realms, and helping man to organize his mental unification of the world in order to purify it. He is given guidelines like the rulers of the Decani. 36 fixed stars, which are called horoscopi. Is the god named Pantomorphos. He it is that gives to the individuals of each kind their diverse forms. And then also we are sent the seven spheres, as they are called. And they have as their ruler the deity called Fortune, or Destiny. He changes all things according to the law of natural growth, working with a fixity which is immutable, and which is yet varied by everlasting movement. We have the elements, the four elements themselves, and he's constantly admonishing Asclepius that there are many impious men in the world who lead us away from believing that all this is true, and that this is an activity which we should constantly engage in. The Hermetic doctrines always single out continuity as the essential part of sacrifice. If we think of it just as a periodic cycle activity, we fall prey to the illusions of the world. It's only by continuous practice that we transcend, that wisdom occurs. Because out of the continuity, we notice that it is behind any, it is an ordering behind any of the cycles that could be delineated materially. This is the key to separating it from the psychic realm. Finally, he, near the end of the third chapter of the Asclepius, he gives us an insight into the relationship between eternity and time, and how this process actually focuses for us this whole vast breathing of reality. The cosmos is that in which time is contained, and it is by the progress and movement of time that life is maintained in the cosmos. The process of time is regulated by a fixed order, and time, in its ordered course, renews all things in the cosmos by alternation. all things being subject to this process, there is nothing that stands fast, nothing fixed, nothing free from change. Among the things which come into being, neither among those in heaven nor those on earth, God alone stands unmoved, and with good reason, for he is self-contained, self-derived, wholly self-centered, and in him is no deficiency or imperfection. And this is to say that he moves not in time, but in eternity. God is unmoved from the perspective of time. He is continuously moving from the perspective of eternity. But it should rather be said that eternity also is motionless. Now, the profane mind staggers in paradox, because it isn't attentive. It doesn't follow the waterfall of truth to speak. And so it just picks out bits and pieces. It hears fragments and tries to reconstruct on the basis of a material mind some kind of speculative mirror of what it's supposed to hear. And then it becomes distracted and does other things and doesn't hear. This is timing in the sense of how evil comes into the world. This is how it comes in, from this path of man. This is why man must purify, because he was blooded in. He has to take it out. Why is man the measure of all things? For this arcane is the point. Eternity also is motionless. Into eternity all movements of time go back. And from eternity all movements of time take their beginning. All time cycles in their completion dissolve back into eternity and then fade back into time, starting the cycle. All the time. This is why the material world is discontinuous. It is discontinuous because only eternity has continuity. This is why man's practice of continuity is a holy preparation to receive that sacred epiphany. That's how the Greeks would. This is why the student should be attentive, constant, full term. God then stands unmoved, and eternity likewise is ever changeless, containing in itself a cosmos that is without beginning, even that cosmos which we rightly call imperceptible to sense. This sensible cosmos has been made in the image, the imago, is the Latin, the imago, the image of that other cosmos, and reproduces eternity in a copy. This is the emanation. It's not so much a creation. Within the emanation, there is creation by cycle. But there's an emanation. This is why the Christos is not created. He's emanated. He's outside of time. He's an eternity. This sensible cosmos has been made in the image of that other cosmos and reproduces eternity in a copy. Now time, though it is ever in movement, possesses a faculty of stability peculiar to itself. Time is stable, but in a very peculiar way, in that its return into itself is determined by necessity. And accordingly, though eternity is stable, fixed, and motionless, yet since time is mobile and its movement ever goes back into eternity, it results from this that eternity also, though motionless in itself, appears to be in motion. This is why Plato says, in the Timaeus, time is the moving image of eternity. If you believe that time is moving, you're trapped in the world. If you sharpen your composition of perception to a spiritual mode, you can see that time is but the moving image of eternity. This is difficult. This is holding perception to help. One of the most poignant presentations of this is in the writings of Martin Buber. The moment of man's existential awareness of who he is when he sees through to what is true about himself. He isn't employed in such and such a place. He isn't living in such and such a place. He is wholly other than that. Not believing that produces a crisis, an anxiety. Trying to believe that he is so and so, employed such and such a place and living such and such a place, trying to force that belief upon himself. Like trying to crush snowballs in a hot still. Keep melting in the water, keep them down, and no, it's got to be a snowball. And so these masks of self keep crumbling in the face of truth. It is this sort of eternity that enters into all the parts of which the cosmos is composed. The eternity is everything. For the cosmos, changeless in virtue of the unalterable law by which its motion is determined, revolves with an everlasting moment. That movement has had no beginning and will have no end. It manifests itself and disappears by turns into the several parts of the cosmos, and that in such fashion that it again and again in the checkered course of time, it manifests itself anew in those same parts in which it disappeared before. Such is the nature of circular movement. All points in the circle are so linked together that you can find no place at which the movement can begin. For it is evident that all points in the line of movement both precede and follow one another forever. And it is in this manner that time revolves. The divine mind is wholly of like nature with this eternity. And I'm going to end there because we're being strained in our perception. But the Asclepius, as delivers then, in its three parts together, a condensed, a telescoped bridge, if you will, of a crisis of transformation in the human mind. And the integrity of the flow of meaning that has not changed, but that the circumstances of its presentation have changed in those three time periods is the healing aspect of the Asclepius. And the final 20 pages of the Asclepius are all admonitions to Asclepius by Hermes to pay attention to the times, to pay attention to the apocalyptic changes that are coming. And he says, even the sacred land of Egypt will be so bereft of religious understanding that the people will think that these were but childish dreams of childish people. I think we should end there. Let's do that.